The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salner, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, Q&A edition for this week. Got a lot of exciting questions this week, I'm assured. I just made that up, but I'm assuming that that's going to be the case. Jim will share with us the questions we have for this week momentarily. I know we're going to start off with a Social Security-style question, as is tradition here on the Retirement and IRA Show. Remember, if you want to send in your own questions, best way to do that would be to go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you can fill in the contact us form, submit your questions that way. You can also email Jim directly. Jim at jimhelps.com would be his email address. So welcome, Jim, to this fine Tuesday, as we're recording this. Most people will listen to this on Saturday or afterwards, but happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday. Thank you. How was your Memorial Day holiday?
Wet, as I was
worried
about.
It rained one day. I was kind of let down. They said it was going to rain all day Sunday, all day Monday. We got a pretty good downpours on Sunday, but Monday was...
Yeah, up in the mountains it was worse. It was more rain up there.
Oh, okay.
Did you start this Saturday evening? Rained all day Sunday. So Sunday afternoon, I gave up and came back home. And then it finally broke about midday. Well, by Monday morning, so Memorial Day, it was a little bit nicer but cloudy, but still pretty cold up there. It was in the 40s. So it was okay. Saturday was beautiful until it started raining that evening.
Well, you got to go home earlier. Sleep in a nice warm bed.
Yeah, but then I had to mow my lawn, so I would have preferred to stay camping.
Well, my weekend was nice. Went out to a place in Louisville on Friday evening. I don't want to name the place, but the food was horrendous. And it was okay. It was nice company, but lousy place. I won't go back there again. Saturday, had a nice hike. And enjoyed that out in the burbs of Boulder. And Sunday, I enjoyed a nice rainy do-nothing day around the house. And Monday, worked in my garden.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
Your garden's got to be looking glorious this year since we've had...
My lettuce this year.
More rain
yeah,
than...
Yeah, the cold season crops, my peas and lettuce.
Oh, those are going crazy, I bet.
Oh, yeah, which suffered last year. Last year, I had to finally give up on my lettuce. I mean, you just couldn't. It was so hot, and lettuce hates heat. To this year, it's loving it. If I knew it was going to be like this, I would have planted a heck of a lot more than I already did. But, no, the lettuce is coming in good. The peas are coming in good. My onions are doing phenomenal. So a lot of those. I don't plant my warm crops until June. I've learned through too many times. You know, they tell you in Colorado, folks, yeah, after Mother's Day, that's BS. Because we can always have one of those weird cold nights that come in out of nowhere, mm-hmm, and just kill everything. So I've learned And this weekend is when I was going to plant, but of course, Saturday was my day, and then Sunday it rained, and Monday it was still too muddy to get a lot of planting done. So the warm weather crops, I won't really plant until this week and this coming weekend. But the cool weather crops, they're loving it right now.
Well, feel free to bring some of those peas in if you have too many.
Yeah, I know you and your family love the peas. The pea plants are large, and the flowers are just coming out. So the peas aren't quite there yet, but they're just loving this weather. And last year, I was struggling to get peas to grow. All righty. So, folks, this is the Q&A show of the Retirement and IRA show.
Gardening and Q&A.
Gardening and Q&A. And we got a bunch of Qs, and hopefully we're going to fire off some A's. We are always going to begin, when we have them, with a Social Security question, which... I had right in my stack of stuff. There it is. Okay. All right. So we got to, you can answer this, Chris, with one arm tied behind your back.
Well, don't set the bar too high.
Two arms tied behind your back, blindfolded. You could still answer this question.
Okay. I hope you're right.
You better, because I'm setting you up. All right. So this came in from a quote unquote Georgette from the beautiful state of Michigan. She says, I was born in 1954. I am at my full retirement age. My benefit is about, all these numbers are approximate, she said, $900. If I delay taking my Social Security until 70, my full benefit will be about $1,150. My husband is younger than me. He was born in 1958. He is going to delay taking his Social Security until 70. He will receive at his full retirement age, or is eligible to receive at his full retirement age, $3,150, and at age 70, $4,000. Again, all these numbers are approximate. Mm-hmm. Question revolves her, Chris. Mm-hmm. She says, if I begin collecting Social Security on my record now, when my husband files at his age 70, will I be eligible for the spousal offset? From my understanding, I would be collecting $900 now until he files at age 70. At that point, I would receive an offset, a spousal offset, of about $675 to bring my total benefit to half of my husband's primary insurance amount. Which, folks, if you don't know what a primary insurance amount is, it's pretty much the amount the husband would have received at his full retirement age, which for him would have been, what, like 66 and a half, 66?
66 and 8 months on a 58 birthday.
Okay. Okay, so... where is it? Is my understanding correct? I do not see any scenario where it does not make sense for me to file now and, excuse me, to, does not make sense for me to file now and instead delay, since 50% of my husband's primary insurance amount is more than my age 70 benefit.
Got it.
If I do this, do I have to file for the spousal offset when my husband turns 70, or will Social Security just do that automatically? Thank you, and I love your show.
Well, nice. Good question. So, yes, I can answer this question. So Jim didn't set me up for failure, luckily.
With two arms tied behind your back, blindfolded?
Yeah, just not... duct tape over my mouth, that would make it harder.
That would make it a little harder, yes.
But, yeah, since I can freely speak here, she's gotten a good understanding of the situation. So the basics of this type of scenario, when you file for your own benefit, you will unlock the door for a potential spousal benefit. That spousal benefit will be a maximum of one half of your own PIA, primary insurance amount. So in this case... half of hers isn't going to help her husband much because his benefit is way bigger. But in the flip side, what she's describing is if he files half of his benefit, is substantial, and it is bigger than her own benefit and bigger than her own benefit could ever be, even through delaying to 70. So short answer here I'll start with, and I'll clarify a few things or point out a few things people always need to know about spousal benefits and filing for them, is that her proposal I agree with. She should not delay any further claiming her own benefits. Now that she's at her own full retirement age, she should claim her benefit of what she said was $900 a month. Upon her husband claiming his benefit, that will then unlock the door for the spousal benefit. The spousal benefit maxes at half of his PIA. She quoted his PIA of $3,150. Half of that is $1,575. So she will be entitled to a benefit of $1,575 per month once he files for his benefit. Until that point, she's only entitled to her own benefit, which is $900. But since whether she's claiming $900, $1,000, $1,200, $1,300, any of those figures, when he turned on his benefit, it's going to top up to $1,575. And so that's what she means by no benefit for delaying. It's true. She would get no benefit long-term for delaying because it's going to top up to that $1,575 regardless of what she chooses to do with her own benefit just because of the way the numbers work out. So I agree. She should file for her own benefit of $900 a month. And then when he files, which sounds like they're targeting age 70 to create that largest benefit, which will be around for either survivor, whichever the two of them lives the longest, she quoted it as $4,000. Now, a little misconception a lot of people have is she is never going to be entitled to half of his age 70 benefit. She does not get $2,000 as a spousal because he delayed to create his own benefit of $4,000. The spousal benefit is always based on one half of your PIA, or the husband in this case is PIA. So you might think, well, there's no benefit to delaying then for her. Well, there is in the survivor benefit. The survivor benefit, unlike spousal, the survivor benefit retains any delayed retirement credits. So growing the benefit for him to $4,000 will carry on regardless of whether he outlives her or she outlives him. Those delayed retirement credits he's aiming to create by waiting till 70 will stick with them, regardless of whichever of the two of them lives longest. Now, this scenario would have changed a little bit. So that's the semi-short answer to her. Yes, I think you should go claim right now. If you haven't already, go out and claim. And then when your husband claims, get the spousal. A lot of times you can have your record indicate that. And when he claims, all he needs to do is remind them of your spousal benefit. But oftentimes they've got you connected in the system. It should work automatically, but it may not. You'll want to, wouldn't hurt to be proactive and notify them or make a phone call or a visit to your local office to make sure that your spousal benefit starts the same month that his benefit starts. But a little caveat for other people of different ages. If you were claiming your benefit before your full retirement age, that $900 would be less, right? And depending on when you claim, it would be, you know, a variety of less. The maximum less it would be for someone age with an age 66 full retirement age is 25% less than that. That would be at 62. Those of us who have a full retirement age of 67, the maximum discount or reduction for claiming early at 62 is 30%. But for her, she could have eroded her own benefit by as much as 25%. Had this scenario changed and she was just turning 62, for instance, her benefit instead of $900 would have been $675, a reduction of $225 a month. What a lot of people don't realize is if you were to do that, it is true her spousal benefit could be as much as $1,575. But if she claims her own benefit early, that $225 reduction sticks with her forever. will go away with this. Doesn't affect her ultimate survivor benefit. So that survivor benefit we talked about before of the $4,000 a month, which is going to be handy for either one of them as a survivor, that's unaffected. But her own, in combination with the spousal offset, they call it, that extra $675 that's topping up her $900 to the $1,575 potential one half spousal benefit we talked about before, the $225 reduction, which reduced the $900, that will haunt her as long as she's alive. Well, as long as both of them are alive, let me say it, that's more accurate. Goes away when either one of them passes away. But while they're both alive, that $225 a month penalty or reduction, it's not really a penalty, lives with you. So even when he claims at 70, unlocking the door to the spousal, the potential spousal benefit for her would have been $1,575, but now, due to the math, is going to be maxed out at $1,350. Okay, they don't top you up all the way to the $1,575. They're going to remind you, hey, you decided to take your own early, so that base amount, that $900 that we normally would have thrown the $675 on top of, we're going to give you the $675, but it's going to be on top of that lower benefit that you claimed at 62. Be aware of that. And then if you claim your spousal offset early, the $675 can be reduced. So there's lots of ways things could have been reduced and therefore incentivize her, possibly, to at least wait to her full retirement age. But once you get to your full retirement age, there's now no lingering reduction that you could incur from claiming early in a case like hers. But don't run out and take my comment to her that I agreed upon her base approach, which is to run out and claim right now. No reason to wait. Claim her $900 now. If she were under her full retirement age, I wouldn't have been so quick as to agree with her. I would remind her that she would be incurring a permanent, as long as they're both alive, penalty of a reduction to her potential benefit. Where if she makes it, at least she's patient enough to at least get to her full retirement age, she wouldn't have to worry about that. She's there now. She doesn't have to worry about that kind of reduction. So just wanted to point that out for other people listening who might not yet be their full retirement age. There are ramifications, permanent ramifications, to claiming your own benefit early, even when you're ultimately going to be claiming a spousal benefit.
Perfect. Told you could answer that. Would you arms tied behind your back or eyes closed?
I did. Well, to practice, I sat on my hands while I was saying that just to...
See, I can't do that. Y'all can't see me when I talk, but I talk, my hands...
Right, his mouth stops working when he sits on his hands.
I have to move my hands to talk. I cannot just sit there and talk without moving my arms. I think that's an East Coast thing. I don't know.
Or Portuguese or something.
Or Portuguese, mm-hmm. the fiery little Mediterranean in me, I guess.
Maybe.
But I did dig up another Social Security question.
Oh, okay.
And it's kind of related to the one you're already answering, so I thought we can kill two birds with one stone, kind of.
Okay. Kind of.
Okay, so he gives his real name, but we're going to protect his anonymity and always call him George. He is from I don't know where. He doesn't say. Anyways, it begins, Dear Jim and or Chris. So mm-hmm. I guess it doesn't matter which one gets the email. I listen as much to all your podcasts you put out, which, by the way, is quite prolific, right? Mm-hmm. Prolific?
Prolific, yeah.
Prolific. Mm-hmm. See, I nailed it.
Well, the second time.
And sometimes get confused on the questions about Social Security. But I have two of my own to run by you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your time and any answers you can give me. Jim, I love your comprehensive answers you give. And Chris, I love your short answers you give. So I guess he likes both.
Likes them both. Perfect. We're the show for you.
However, I think only the first part of my question warrants a yes or no answer. I think he's setting the stage that he wants a little bit more on his second question, Chris. Okay. Okay, here are my two questions. It's my understanding, if I'm correct, that if I pass before my spouse, sound familiar? Mm-hmm. Me being 66 and she being 57 right now, and I have started taking my Social Security, I do plan on waiting until 70, she will continue receiving the full amount I had been receiving as a survivor benefit. Yes or no?
What were the ages?
He is 66. She is 57. He's going to wait till 70.
Well, guess what? It's not a yes or no answer.
Oh, well, listener, you're going to get...
It's a maybe, and I can expand on that.
Okay.
So he's 66. He's planning to wait till 70. When he turns 70, she will be, by my calculation, about 61. Right?
Yes.
Perfect. So she potentially could receive 100% of what he was receiving that he was getting at 70, but only once she reaches her own full retirement age. So if she were to claim her survivor benefit from you before turning 67, so waiting six more years, she would get a reduced survivor benefit, reduced permanently for the rest of her life. Survivor benefits are also reduced by claiming, quote, early. So it isn't just you waiting to 70 that maxes it out and makes it, quote, permanent for your spouse. She, in this case, needs to wait to her full retirement age to get there. Now, if you pass away late enough, she'll have gotten to that, and then the answer would have been, yes. If you would have told me, if I pass away then at 80, will she get 100% of what I was getting? That question, I could have just said yes. In this case, it depends on how old she is when she starts receiving the survivor benefit. Now, the good news is she can choose to wait. When you pass away, she's not forced to take a reduced amount. She has the option of waiting until she gets to her full retirement age before turning it on. She wouldn't want to wait beyond that because nothing she does will make it bigger than you were receiving, but something she does could make it smaller, claiming early. Now, if she had her own benefit, she could claim her own benefit for a while she's waiting for your benefit to reach its maximum amount, which would be at her full retirement age, and then switch over to yours. Or depending on the numbers, sometimes it's the opposite that makes sense. Claim the survivor, the reduced survivor first, and then let her own grow to maybe 70 and then switch over. All depends on what the amounts are. You haven't provided me with that, but am I doing a really good job of ruining his hope that I can answer yes or no to this?
He likes my long answers too, so he should be ecstatic. He got your short maybe and my long version from you.
Perfect. So, well, maybe the second part is a yes or no, and he thinks it's a long answer, but there's the answer to the first one. Maybe for the reasons I just described.
I think the second one is a little bit easier, and he's actually got three questions, but he only references two.
Okay.
Okay. Number two. Mm-hmm. In the event I die before age 70, what benefit will my wife receive? Will it be what Social Security determines are the payments I would have received at the time of my demise?
Yes.
Oh, there you go. There's his yes or no answer.
Right. The way to think about that is the survivor benefit will be dependent, if you haven't claimed yet, it'll be set essentially by what you could have claimed had you filed for benefits the day before you passed away. So any delayed retirement credits that you have begun to accrue as you're trying to get to 70, which I think is the case here because he was talking about waiting till 70, if you only make it to 68 or 69, they'll at least give her the benefit of the delayed retirement credits up to that point, even though you never collected a dime yourself. They're going to look at what you could have received had you claimed the day before you passed away, and that will then become the survivor benefit potential for her, which she then, like I said before, could reduce it even further by claiming it earlier than her own full retirement age, but could have the maximum potential of whatever you could have claimed had you claimed the day before you died. So that's I embellished it a little bit, but that was closer to a yes or no question than the first one, actually.
Okay, the next one, I'll ask the question. I don't think we'll get too deep into it, but he says, in the case of my wife being 9 years younger than me, are there any Social Security strategies we should use for her starting to receive her own benefit? Her benefit will be much less than mine. Would you have her take her benefit at 62? Or some other age, I feel that my life expectancy should reach 90. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
This one's going to be a gray area. This isn't going to be an absolute without knowing the full scope of the situation. I would say if you have ample resources, I prefer it. And this, you know, could be more of a psychological thing than anything. I like to not take a penalty. I like to not volunteer for a reduction in benefits. But it is possible, depending on the circumstances, that you could make an argument for her claiming her benefit quite young, knowing that the statistics are that she's going to be a single survivor for an extended period of time. He being male and 9 years older, the numbers would tell us she's going to be collecting the survivor benefit. So her own benefit isn't as critical to grow by delaying, by waiting, as it otherwise might be, because she's going to likely, and again, we're just when we say likely and probably, it's just statistically, but this could all get blown out of the water and he could outlive her, right? You have to, you know, face that. So since you don't know, if you want to play the odds, then you might want to consider claiming early, like you mentioned, even at 62. But what I would probably, since we don't know and we're just playing the odds aren't super helpful when you're talking about a single instance. And what I mean by that is the odds are great when you're trying to predict what to do as a group, as a population. You know, what's the general advice that the median or average person could do? I think in your, you know, when you have just a single client or a single case, a single life to live, if you will, he could die first, she could die first, they could die simultaneously, they could both live to 100, they could, you know, neither make it to 70. Who knows? I don't care what your family history is. One of those, something you can't predict is going to happen. So the overriding factor in my mind would be, what are your other financial resources look like? What other secure income might you have beyond Social Security? Do you need the money now? Would you prefer to have income coming in to try to protect more of your assets to leave to kids? Or is that not a particular issue? There's more to retirement than just the Social Security decision. So this is one where I would not try to make a standalone decision, but a more comprehensive decision about your whole story. Because the only way I can tell you what was absolutely the right approach in a decision like you're talking about is after you've both passed away, I'll let your beneficiaries know what you should have done. Because at that point, it will become clear, which obviously is being facetious.
Yes. So. Were you done?
Yeah.
Oh.
I feel pretty good about that one, yeah.
Right. Excellent. All righty, now we're going to get into a boatload of IRA questions. So we're going to bring the IRA back into
how many is a boatload? I just want to make sure I have enough paper.
We got a ton of questions in over the last 2 weeks. I don't know why, but we did. Okay. But we had a ton and a half from previous. We are far behind. And, you know, we did get an email from a listener. I can't find it in front of me. I wish I did. He had a brilliant solution to our conundrum, if you will.
Take no clients and just do podcasts?
No. Oh. You don't want to do two shows a week, correct? Just admit it.
Is this a trick question? I'm not. Well, yeah. If I didn't have anything else to do, I don't mind doing podcasts. Let me hedge my answer. Don't mind doing the podcast. I have nothing against doing podcasts. I don't mind talking into this microphone and pretending like there's people out there. I'm fine with that. It's just the other obligations that I have get in the way.
True. So you don't want to do a second Q&A podcast.
I don't feel like I can fit that in.
Right. I get that. So his solution was, and I wanted to do an additional show.
And you can't fit it in either, so I'm not sure where you're talking about.
My schedule is worse than yours. But his solution was, we do one show, but just do it for 2 hours. We both win.
That's a little more efficient, yes, than doing multiple shows.
See?
But this show is supposed to be 45 minutes or so, and it turns out to be an hour and 15 to an hour and a half a lot of times. So if we had a goal of two, we'd have a three-hour podcast, and how many people are going to listen to that?
Yeah, well,
I don't. Oh, my gosh. I guess we could cut it up into two pieces and post it separately. But still, that's a lot of talking.
I would have no problem with it, but other people would. All righty. Anyways, let's jump into a bunch of IRA questions. that we'll get into. We rose to the top of the pile to find people from the state of Ohio. Ever since I added Ohio to the list of Kentucky and Ohio jumped to the top of the list, we've been getting a ton of questions from Ohio.
Oh, good.
Okay, so it begins. Hi, Jim and Chris. Longtime listener from Ohio. Jim's future home. Jim's potential future home, folks. I will be visiting the fine state of Ohio, Southern Ohio, in the Cincinnati area, I think in about 4 weeks now. I purposefully chose July because Chris is adamant. If I visit the Ohio River Valley in July or August, I will be so miserable I will shut up about this and never go back. So I will be out there for a couple of weeks in late July.
In an apartment with no air conditioning.
No, I made sure on the Airbnb they had AC, but it's an old home built in 1923.
Well, you should live it in a historical fashion.
Well, there's no central air back then, so I know we're talking window units. Mm-hmm. And I'm on the second floor. I don't like window units on the first floor. I always worry that someone's going to push them out and climb through the window. So I'm on the second floor, and they did say that there's ample window units. There better be, because if there isn't, oh, man, am I going to be miserable without AC. Okay, I have recently turned 59 and a half, and I'm wondering whether this key milestone should be a driving action on my retirement planning. I have a 403B and a 457 with my nonprofit employer, and I have them broken up about 50-50 between traditional and Roth contributions. I also have several Roth IRAs, but no traditional IRAs. Should I consider a tax-free rollover of any of the money in my 403B into an IRA? Same question for my 457. There are no truly unique investment offerings that my employer has in the plans that I can't get in an IRA somewhere else. So that's not an important consideration for me. I know there may be some differences in creditor protection in the 403B and 457 that my employer's plan, are technically my employer's. I don't understand what he just wrote. I'll read what he wrote, but it's not making any sense to me. I know that there are technically some differences in creditor protections within the 403B and the 457 contributions are technically my employer's property and subject to their creditors. And he's wrong on that.
Well, the 457s that are not government 457s are fair game for the employer's creditors.
But this is a non-profit. I'm guessing a 403B and a 457. I thought he was working for a school district.
Yeah, it would depend on the status of the employer. Most 457s that people run into, because they're with school systems, universities, etc., do not have that creditor vulnerability of the employer itself. But 457s from private companies do have that vulnerability of the creditors of the employer itself. Now, if your employer is, likely to for that to happen, it might not be that scary for you. But that is a reason why you might want to roll that out if there is a potential for an employer to be hit by large creditor claims. It is true that the 457s from in those small percentage of instances, not too many people have these, but there's a possibility, I guess we could say, without knowing the exact status of the employer, we won't know for sure. But it is possible, Jim, as Jim knows.
It is possible, but I think he's confusing that little known fact you just mentioned with his 457. I would wager his 457 is protected. But do keep in mind, listener, that your 403B and 457 may not be ERISA plans. I'm not 100% sure because I don't know who you're working for. Usually when I see a 403B and a 457, I do think school district or school, could be a private school. But he does reference nonprofit, not a school. So yeah. You need to find out from your plan sponsor If your plan is an ERISA plan, you can just call them up and ask them, is this an ERISA plan? Or get the statement of additional information or the what do they call that? That's on the
IRA. A lot of 457s aren't going to be ERISA because they are government entities, which are exempt from ERISA.
That's what I was getting at. They 403Bs as well.
They have the same, though they get the same creditor protection as ERISA plans, though. So that's really the essence here. But in his case, he's going to need to confirm, and maybe he made the comment because he has confirmed it, that if it's not a governmental employer, 457s are vulnerable to the creditors of the employer itself.
So. Do keep in mind, listener, when you're talking the creditor protection, there's two types of creditors. There's the bankruptcy and the general creditor. Bankruptcy is provided under federal law. And a non-ERISA plan, I'm looking at the EdSlot summary right in front of me. Non-ERISA plans, which again, I don't know if your 403B and 457 are ERISA or not. My gut tells me they're not. But it says non-ERISA plans, 100% federal bankruptcy protection. So do keep that in mind. The creditor protection, folks, and to this listener in particular, is granted at the state level. Do keep that in mind. An ERISA plan, creditors are protected at the federal level, and it's unlimited. But a non-ERISA plan, if you have one, general creditors, those are the people who'll sue you if you ran a red light and caused an accident, someone slipped and fell on the ice in front of your house and says you should have cleaned it and they're suing you. It's a general creditor. General creditors in an ERISA plan are held at bay. State law doesn't protect it. Federal law does. But a non-ERISA plan, the protection is based on the state of Ohio. If you truly do live in Ohio, I know Chris sometimes thinks people lie and just say they do to jump to the top of the list, but if you truly do live in the state of Ohio, you need to check to see what they grant general creditor protection. But bankruptcy protection, folks, is granted at the federal level.
But to be clear, if it is one of these non-governmental 457s, that's protection from the participants' bankruptcy and creditors. The creditors and bankruptcy of the employer still put at risk the 457.
True, but I don't think he's in that kind of 457.
Yeah, they're not very common, but they do exist. So, I mean, we want to acknowledge that it is possible.
Okay.
But we'd have to know more about his employer to know for sure.
Back to his general question then. So what you were saying there, listener, I don't think applies to you, and you continued with your question. Although my employer is quite large and in strong financial shape, see, it's that part, Chris, that made me think he's in a university. Usually a nonprofit isn't huge, although it can be. He could be working for a national nonprofit somewhere. But anyways, although my employer is quite large and in strong financial shape, would this be a good strategy? Are there any other key advantages or disadvantages or other strategies I should consider after reaching this age? Thanks for your help, Buckeye George.
I do want to point out, I think the essence of his question, to just remind people, why is he focusing on this 59 and a half thing? A lot of these plans, 457 in particular, the advantage is that you can access it before 59 and a half without the early withdrawal penalty. So he's essentially saying, now that I've passed that hurdle where all of my retirement accounts are now available with very rare exceptions, without any kinds of penalties, or extra taxes. And I say it that way because maybe Jim will pick up on this. If you're over 59 and a half, but you haven't met the 5-year aging rule with the Roth, you might have some extra taxes that are owed on certain distributions. But for the most part, you can ignore any type of early penalties for withdrawals once you get to 59 and a half. So the argument classically made, which is to leave some money behind if you're younger than 59 and a half in some of these types of accounts where you can access the money without the early withdrawal penalty, it can make some sense. But he's now reached that line of his life, or in the timeline of his life, and wonders, do I really need to worry about any of that anymore? Is there something else I should worry about and keep it in there instead of rolling it out and doing something else with it?
Yeah, when I read this question, because we don't have a tremendous amount of information, I just assumed he did his homework, and he may not have, and he's going to have to find out. But he did his homework, and at age 59 and a half, his employer allows in-service distributions. It's not a given, folks.
True.
Employers have to allow it. Some, it's later. I know I've mentioned before, I serve on the retirement board of a Northern Colorado employer. I won't be doing that much longer. I'm just too busy now. But their age, Chris, is 63. Mm-hmm. So they make the employees wait till 63. So I'm assuming at 59 and a half, he has the ability to do an in-service distribution. That means no restrictions. You can just go in there and grab your money. And if that's the case, he's saying, hey, half is in the traditional pot, half is in the Roth pot. And I'm assuming the Roth pot is in the 403B because I don't believe Roth 457s exist.
I thought they did.
I thought they didn't. But
I'll check while
I'm not 100%
correct. I could have sworn I'd run across Roth, but go ahead.
They very well may, but I thought they didn't exist. Anyways, back to what he's asking. He's asking, folks, do you see any benefits to leaving it at the employer plan or moving it? Well, again, at the employer plan, at the employer level, the bankruptcy, if it's a non-ERISA plan, is still going to be protected under federal law. If you move it to an IRA, listener, and you are worried about bankruptcy protection, if you move it to an IRA, you only get protection. And here's where it gets a little bit difficult in the sense you got to keep really good records. Your IRA, whether it's your Roth, and you said you don't have a does he have a traditional or?
He has no traditional IRAs. Traditional.
Okay. So contributions and growth associated with those contributions made to an IRA, whether it's a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA, and they look at all your IRAs as one big one, is protected to about $1.3 million. It's actually $1,362,800. They change that every year, so it'll go higher each and every year. But about $1.3 million is protected. But there is unlimited protection on monies transferred in from employer plans because they have 100% federal protection to begin with. And that carries over and it won't reduce the $1.3 million protection you get on contributions and the associated growth. Everything else, the transferred amount from an employer plan and the associated growth on that transferred amount, is unlimited protected and excluded from the $1.3 million. We get this question all the time, though, Chris. If I mix them, does it ruin? If I move my employer plan into my IRA, am I now limited to only the $1.3 million? No. However, from an accounting standpoint, it could be a nightmare if you ever did get hauled into bankruptcy court trying to prove, and you did have more than $1.3 million in the IRA, trying to prove to the court that, hey, this isn't subject to the $1.3 million limit. It's because I took some of it or all of it from a 401k or another employer-style plan in this case. And it has unlimited protection. It's just going to be hard trying to show all that. So we sometimes will have people who will keep it separate for that reason. But you don't have to. If you don't have much in your IRA or there's not much in the 401k and you're not worried about the difficulty in maybe trying to track it, you don't have to keep multiple accounts. At all. You just have to be able to track, hey, this is the money that came in, and then this is the associated earnings on it. There's a formula that you would use to figure that out. It can get a little bit difficult, but it's the same formula you would use at the government level when you are being forced to take money, an excess contribution out of your IRA. They say you have to take out the contribution plus any associated earnings minus any associated losses. They have a formula for figuring that out. It's the same kind of formula you would use in this case. So you can track the amount of money you put in from the 401k and the growth associated with that. If you don't mind doing that, you don't have to keep them separate. But he's also asking, are there any pros and cons? Well, he kind of answered some of the pros and cons already, the bankruptcy and creditor protection. If you're worried about creditor protection, you got to find out what Ohio is going to offer. If Ohio has very poor IRA creditor protection, you may not want to move it. However, if you have a non-ERISA plan, you're limited to state law protection anyways for non-bankruptcy creditors. So it would be a moot point if you kept it in the non-ERISA plan or an IRA. It's still protected under state law. So you need to find out what Ohio offers and if you have an ERISA plan or not, if you're truly worried about creditor protection as well. Other than that, folks, we look at investment options. He said there's really nothing stellar in those plans, Chris, that he couldn't get on his own inside the IRA. Mm-hmm. Then you may want to look at the fees of those plans, and here is where it can get a little bit difficult, if not a lot difficult, trying to understand really what you're paying. Some plans will charge an outright fee to their employees, and they itemize it and show it right on their 401k statements. Others, the fees are buried in the share class of the investments you have inside the 401k. So what you really need to look at, and that's where most will be, especially on 403bs. 403bs are the wild west of plans. And I highly doubt that 403b is ERISA protected at all. So 403bs tend to have very high cost investments in them. That's one of the issues with 403Bs, because they're non-ERISA plans and they're not highly regulated. You need to look at the cost of those investments inside the 403B. And if those costs are fairly high and you can get the same fund or similar funds at a lower cost outside, that might be a reason to move it. But if you are concerned about bankruptcy and creditor protection, get it, just dot that T and cross that I when you have that chance.
Or reverse that. We're going to dot I's and cross T's instead.
That's what I said. Dot a T and cross an I. No. Dot an I and cross a T.
There you go.
Did I say it the other way?
Yes, you did.
Oh, damn it. All right. Never mind. I was on a roll.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to make sure people realized I do listen as he's talking. And there are definitely Roth 457s.
There are Roth 457s? Yeah. Okay. I was not sure. Thank you for correcting me.
No problem.
So there's nothing in his email, Chris, that's jumping out at me to say don't move it or move it. I think it's really going to be a personal decision.
I vote for simplicity. I like that. Although he's not so old that we'd start to be concerned with making silly mistakes, but why make your life more complicated than it needs to be? Fewer, unless there's a good reason to have separate accounts, I think consolidation is worthy of consideration.
But he's still working and he's still going to be putting money in, so consolidation
isn't
to me
help him that much,
would be keep the accounts until you retire and then move it.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is 403Bs have never impressed me as a retirement savings vehicle. I found them to be funded a lot with insurance company offerings, mm-hmm. with very high fees.
Well, their other name is tax-deferred annuity, TDA.
Yeah, I mean, that says it all.
That's a 403B right there.
And I would wager if you have one that's not well-run, it could have very high cost funds. Don't just look at the type of funds. Look at the cost you're paying on them, listener. And my gut tells me they're very expensive and you can find lower cost options, either with similar funds or exchange traded funds, maybe even the same fund, but sold in a different share class than you have that might even be less expensive. I think that, to me, is going to be the big one. Look at what you're paying in the investment options. You might be able to save some money outside of those. Now, if you are going to use an investment advisor to help you with all this, you now have to look at their fee as well and see, well, okay, they might save me 50 basis points, which is 0.5%, folks, 50 basis points on my mutual fund fees, but if the advisor is going to charge you 100 basis points to manage it, you're now losing 50 basis right. points more right. than if you just left it there. So the high fees in the 457 and the 403B, those are generally the reason the 457 and 403B is not charging you a separate fee. The cost of running that account comes from that high fee. It's called revenue sharing. The providers of those funds inside your 457 plan has agreed to give a portion of those fees to the provider to offset their cost, to the sponsor rather, to offset their cost. And it's that revenue sharing that makes this a little hard to figure out. But you can look at the expense ratio of the investment options. I think if they're high, you might want to move to save some money on that.
Yeah, good points.
All right. Well, where was the other one from the Ohio one? Uh-oh.
Couldn't tell you.
Well, it ain't here. It's not here. It just got up and walked away. So I'm just going to read the
next. I stayed in my room just for
I know you stayed in your room, but this irks the heck out of me. It was right here. And, well, if you all saw the little card desk that I get. I'm back in, by the way,
folks.
You
have a full-size card table just for you.
Yes, but
it's full. It normally seats four people at a party playing cards.
But I got it full. And anyways, there's papers everywhere, and I can't find it. I will find the Ohioan question, but I'm on to the next one. Okay. It says, hello, Jim and Chris. Oh, I did find it. From the great state of Ohio. But
right in front of you.
It's right in front of me. Yeah. He doesn't say where. He might be a liar. Liar pants on fire.
Wow. That's a bold statement.
I don't know. Well, the other guy kind of, you know, talked a little bit more about Ohio. Mm. But anyways.
Use the buzzword Buckeye.
Yes, he did sign it, Buckeye George. Mm-hmm. What is a Buckeye, since I might move there?
Isn't that a nut, like a...
I have no idea.
Walnut-looking thing?
Why would you... Buckeye? No.
Isn't it?
I have no idea.
I might have just sounded really stupid, but I'll look it up while
look
you're talking.
Hello, Jim and Chris from the great state of Ohio. Is there a proper sequencing for taking...
Yeah, it's a dark brown nut from the buckeye tree. Yeah, they must have a lot of them there.
They must have a lot of them. I wonder what they taste like. I will find out when I go out there. Wonder if I can get a pound of roasted buckeyes, please. Is there a proper sequence in taking QCDs and RMDs and Roth conversions? QCDs, folks, in case you don't know, qualified charitable distributions available to IRA owners once they reach the age of 70 and a half, allows them to take money directly from their IRA up to $100,000 a year and give it to charity and not have to declare it as income. However, the first dollars out are always your RMD. So if you're looking to reduce your required minimum distributions and do it with QCDs, make sure the QCDs come out first.
Yep.
To reduce your RMDs. Okay, so he says, next year I will be 72 and forced to start taking my required minimum distributions. If you're going to be 72 next year, listener, you most likely are already or soon to be 70 and a half this year. So QCDs can probably start for him this year, Chris, although I can't say for certain.
Yeah, no, he's definitely, if he's 72 next year, he's...
He should be 70 and a half sometime this year.
Yeah, you'd think, most likely.
Okay. Next year, I'll be 72 and forced to take my RMDs. I expect my required minimum distributions to be $125,000. Next year, they are using a new table, listener, so make sure you used the new table in your calculation. Mm-hmm. If it isn't, it could be a little bit smaller than that. It's not going to be substantial, maybe $5,000, $6,000 less than $125,000. I don't know if you used the 22 table or not. I plan to do a $100,000 charitable QCD, leaving me just about $25,000 as my required minimum distribution. But I also want to do Roth conversions. Must I do my QCD first and take my required minimum distribution before I do the Roth conversion?
Here's one that somebody's begging for a one-word answer, and you can do it, Jim. I have faith. What's the answer?
I was ready to go on and on and on. You think I can just answer?
But this is one that could be.
Yes.
There you go. Now you can expand on that, but
thank
I just
you.
Wanted to prove to people that you could give a one-word answer.
I could.
And that is the correct answer.
And I stand corrected. I don't think he's a liar, liar, pants on fire anymore, because then he wrote, P.S., it doesn't get that humid in Ohio in the summer.
And he doesn't live there then.
No, because then he goes, and our backyard is so green, and he spelt green in all caps. I think he is a true Ohioan.
It doesn't get that humid.
Well, if you grew maybe up
in,
there.
Well, maybe in his, not. I'm not saying the whole state is like that. There's parts of the state that are worse than others, certainly. Not that I've been around the whole state. I just know that I went to the sweaty armpit of that area, and it was not fun.
You complain if you're in a shower and it gets too steamy. Although I did bump in when I was hiking this week, and I'll just mention this real quick, folks. When I was hiking in Boulder, I'm coming down the Royal Arch Trail, and this young guy looks at me, Chris, and he goes, Jim.
What?
Yeah, and I'm looking, I'm like, dude, who the hell are you? And so I do what I always do when I don't know someone's name.
Hey, how you doing?
Exactly. Which is 90% of the time. I don't remember anyone's name. If you listen to this podcast, you all know I'm terrible with names. So I just looked down and was like, hey, how's it going? And then he goes, how's Chris? He's okay, too.
Yeah, he's good.
And I'm looking at, and I think he knew, and he says his name, and I can't even remember it now. Turns out it's one of your interns from 2 years ago whose dad was a financial planner.
Oh, yeah.
And he
was here?
He was from Ohio. Well, yeah.
He's from Ohio. He moved to Ohio.
He moved back to Ohio.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what his name is. Do you?
Well, I don't want to say in case he wants to say anonymous, but yeah, I remember.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So anyways, he says to me, are you still moving to Northern Kentucky? I says, well, I'm thinking of it. I says, Northern Kentucky. I says, although I said, I have now expanded to Southern Ohio or Northern Kentucky right along the Ohio River. And he says, oh, he says, yeah, you'll like it. And then I told him I'm going to go out there in July. And he says, oh.
Yeah, exactly. He knew. Oh.
And I go, what do you mean, oh? He says, no, you'll have fun. And
to stay inside.
And then I asked him, I says, level with me, be honest. I said, do you live anywhere near there? And he admitted, he says, no, I'm 3 hours north of there. He's up near Lake Erie, I think it is. He says, I'm up near the lake. And I says, well, does it get humid up in your area? And he goes, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He spent a lot of time out here going to school, though, so he might have got unacclimated to it or something, but
I don't know. But he came out for the holiday weekend to do some hiking and see some friends. So that's, I mean, we just randomly bumped into each other on Boulder's trail. It was packed. I mean, there were people everywhere and in the parking lots and streets. I was looking at most of the license plates, not most, but a good 30% of the license plate, Chris, were just other states. Mm-hmm. So anyways, that happened this weekend.
Yeah, that was Mitchell. I won't use his last name.
Oh,
that was
his name was?
That was
okay.
Mitchell, yeah.
All right, so folks, back to this listener from Ohio's question. Yes, there is an ordering. Just keep that in mind. When you are subject to required minimum distributions, now the law is in the year you turn 72, beginning January 1st of the year you turn 72, the first dollars out of your account are required minimum distributions.
Notice how he said are, not could be if you designated them as such. There's no choice. It is what it is. The first dollars out are RMDs.
Your RMDs. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. RMDs can never be what, Chris?
Rolled over.
Or converted, which is
a
rollover.
Rollover, yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So RMDs, Chris is correct, can never be rolled over. A conversion, a Roth conversion, is considered a rollover. Ergo, RMDs cannot be converted. Why? Because RMDs cannot be rolled over. So if you want to do this correctly, listener, beginning next year, when you can give $100,000 directly to charity and you think you're going to have net of that $100,000, still $25,000 of RMD, and you want to do a conversion on top of that, do not do the conversion first. Do the QCD first. You're on the right track there. Do the $100,000 qualified charitable distribution. Take the money from your IRA and send it directly to the charity. Do not take it physically yourself unless you have check writing on your IRA and you physically write the check yourself to the charity. Even if you sign the check and hand it, as long as the check was written out to the charity, that counts as a QCD. But if you take a check made out to you, put it in your account and then write a check to the charity, or endorse a check written out to you to the charity, either of those blow it up and it is not a QCD. So the money goes directly from your IRA to the charity. So do the $100,000 there first, Chris. Then you said you still have $25,000 to take as a RMD. Take that next, then do the conversion.
Yep.
In that order. So there is an ordering rule to follow with QCDs. And if you want to apply, if you don't want to, let me word it this way. If you don't want to reduce your RMD, if that's not important to you from a tax perspective, it doesn't matter if you take the RMD or not, it's not going to impact your taxes at all, then it doesn't matter if you take the RMD first or do the QCD first. But if you want to use the QCD to reduce your required minimum distribution, you must take it first. You can't take the RMD or take the money out for the RMD and then later take a QCD and say, hey, that was my RMD, so I want to reduce that. It just doesn't work. The first dollars out are always going to be your required minimum distribution.
Yeah. Just to clarify what Jim said at the end there, because I think it might have confused a few people.
Good, because it confused
me
too.
Yeah, what Jim was meaning is if you took the 100 or 125,000 RMD and then realized, oh, crap, I could have done a QCD. Let me take a QCD and then somehow have it wash out or something and offset some of the earlier RMD. No. Once it comes out, there's no putting it back in. It is what it is. Those first 125 that comes out, however it comes out, whether you send it as a QCD or you took it out yourself, that's RMD. And then you can certainly then turn around and send money to the charity, but it's not going to be a QCD anymore. It's going to just be, well, let me take it back. It is going to be a QCD, but it's not going to satisfy any of the RMD. You're not going to undo the $125,000 of recognized income that you're going to have to report from taking a true RMD just because later you make a QCD. So that's what he was getting at, is you, that's why it's important to do it first. If you're wanting it to offset the RMD, QCD first. Or you could take the 20, if you knew that the net was 25, you could take 25,000 RMD first. You still got to take 100, and if you then took the QCD, you still have filled the 125 that you were trying to do with only 25,000 being reported to you as income because the other 100 went to the charity. But you can't retroactively fix it after you've already taken the RMD. That's what Jim was trying to say.
Thank you for that clarification.
That may or may not have helped. I don't know.
I don't know. But that was a good point that you did make, and I got to give Chris credit for that, folks. You don't. If his numbers were correct and it really worked that way, he has to take $125,000. He could take the $25,000
right.
RMD before doing the QCD. That's no problem.
Right.
But if you want to reduce your RMD, you've got to take the QCD first.
Before you eat up your whole RMD.
Correct.
Yep. Perfect.
All right. Hello, Jim and Chris, and thank
you.
Well,
just so you, I'm happy to do another question, but you were trying to get out of here for traffic reasons.
Yep. What time is it?
It's 4:30.
Already?
Already. It's what happens when you don't come up here until later. But
all right, well, this...
Totally up to you.
Since I started, I'll keep going. This one ain't going to take me long.
We'll see.
Hello, Jim and Chris, and thank you for the valuable information you so generously share in your show. I have a question regarding naming beneficiaries on my IRA. Mm-hmm. I understand you should not name your estate as beneficiary since it's not a human, but I am wondering if how I currently have my beneficiaries designated are okay for the same reason. I have my two children each receiving 30%. My two grandchildren each receiving 15%, and my church and college alma mater each receiving 5%. Mm. Is this okay since the church and alma mater are not human beings, or will it cause issues upon my death? Maybe.
I don't like it set up that way personally, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm not against it if you let other people know what they need to be doing.
That's the concern the I have,
So here's the rules, folks. She will have an IRA with many, many beneficiaries. She's going to have two children, two grandchildren, and two charities. The charities are not human, and non-human beneficiaries cause all sorts of problems to IRAs. What has to happen, listener, is the IRA has to pay out those non-human beneficiaries by what is known as the designation date. The designation date is September 30th of the year following the IRA owner's death. So if you died this year, if you died today, June 1st, 2021, the designation date would be September 30th, 2022. Gives a lot of time. September is 9 months next year and 6 months this year, 15 months. But what if you died December 31st? Now there's only 9 months. But during that time, your beneficiaries must request, or executor of your estate must request, someone has got to request that the IRA custodian pay out the non-humans. Mm-hmm. Because on September 30th, that's the day the IRS kind of takes a picture, a snapshot on that date of your beneficiary form. And they're going to say, whoever is on this beneficiary form, whoever remains, is the designation date for setting the distribution rules. And if they see a non-human on September 30th, that is going to take precedence over the distribution rules. I won't get into what those rules can be, but they can blow everything up. It can just be a pain in the hiney.
Mm-hmm. Humans can get preferable distribution rules to non-humans, and you take away that flexibility if you fail to meet this designation date requirement.
Correct.
And that's the trouble, is that not everyone who was left behind after you pass away knows or remembers to do this, and it can get screwed up. So that's the issue.
So my answer is it's not a deal breaker. But just make sure your beneficiary, you got four humans. Make sure all of them know. Don't pick one of the four humans to tell because they might forget. Tell them all. Or leave a letter at your passing just saying, hey, here's what you got to do. Mm-hmm. You got to make sure the non-humans are paid out by the designation date. But if you let the non-humans know this rule exists and they have to act, now granted, you still get anywhere from 9 months plus to get this done. In my hypothetical example, I said 15 months. That's plenty of time for them to get this done. They just can't forget, or there can be a blow up. You could also do what Chris said or suggests. You know, you can break the 10% out of the IRA that you want to leave to the charities and just have the charities named on that IRA, and then you won't have that designation date issue. But then you're going to have another issue. If you always want to maintain 10% of your total IRA balance, You may have to start moving money back and forth. If the inherited IRA starts to grow too much and it's now 11%, you want to get 1% back over to the humans. Or if the humans ones grows and mm-hmm. it's too big and you got to get some back over to the charity, that's just a pain. So having it all on one beneficiary form and breaking it up with the percentages is easier, but you have that designation date rule. If any non-human is on the IRA or still beneficiary of the IRA, say, by September 30th of the year following your death, IRS is just going to fixate on those non-humans and say to the humans, you are still subject to the non-human rules. So just get the non-humans paid out by the designation date.
Perfect.
All right.
Well, I want to thank everybody for listening to another Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. Like I said at the top of the show, if you want to send in your own questions, just go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you'll find the contact form where you can submit questions or comments. You can also email Jim directly. Jim at jimhelps.com is his direct email, and he'll try his best not to lose your question. But if you don't hear for a period of time, maybe send it in again, just as a heads up.
Well, we got people who do that. The problem is, folks, we have way too many questions than we do have time to answer. I mean, we got to level with people. We get far more emails a week than we can handle. My stack of emails keeps growing bigger and bigger. I can tell it's getting bigger because I use one of those clam clips or whatever they call them, you know, those little things you squeeze and they clip on. And I only got a few more pages I can get before I need another whole clip. So it's telling me that we're getting more than what we can answer. And therein lies the problem, folks. So we appreciate everyone writing, but there's no guarantee your question's going to make the cut. So
true. We do get a lot that are similar. So if, as long as you're a regular listener, if you listen long enough, you'll probably get your question answered, I guess I will say. And we actually, when we get a unique question that we don't answer on a regular basis or haven't ever answered, which is occasionally true, we usually pluck that out and answer it because it's kind of exciting to have a brand new question that we really haven't dealt with before.
Especially a unique question from Kentucky.
Especially, yeah. So, but anyway, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll be back with you again next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.